on a string, and that some of these visitors or watchers.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, we have another fascinating topic tonight. But before we jump off to that conversation, we've got our usual announcements to make. Now, for tonight's show, like always, I would love to hear from the listening audience. So, send your questions and comments to me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. I promise I will not give out your full name or email, and I won't send you any spam. So don't be shy. If you have something on your mind, send it in, and we'll see about getting the answer for you. Now, tonight I would also like to ask everybody to call in with their questions and comments. So here is the number. The number is 1-504-273-7379. And once again, we have a fascinating guest tonight. He's an author by the name of Guido Massey. Guido, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Gia. Thanks a lot for having me on the show. It's nice to be here. I'm up in Vermont, and it's still kind of chilly here. We had a windy day of about 45 degrees. But I live and work up here, and I love the difference in seasons that I see. I'm an herbalist who lives in Burlington and works in Montpelier, right in the heart of Vermont, in the Green Mountains. I work clinically, meaning I see folks at my office, and I also garden and teach herbal medicine. And I really have a great time doing it. It's an honor to be out in the forest working with wild plants and to work with some really exceptional folks at the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism and also at this herbal products manufacturing company called Urban Moonshine. And our big mission is to help bring the wild plants that our ancestors used, that really our grandparents used, and that many other cultures of the world still use, back into the kitchen and the home of the American population. And I really am, again, honored and excited to be able to be here and talk about that a little tonight.
Yeah, and before we get started, you want to give everybody the title of your book and tell them where they can find it?
It's called The Wild Medicine Solution, and it talks about exactly that, how these plants and these herbal medicines are a big part of what I think the solution is to a lot of the healthcare issues we see in this country. And you can get the Wild Medicine Solution through innertraditions.com, the publisher that put it together and helped me, and also at your local bookstores and, you know, online in many different places.
Okay. And, folks, this is a really cool little book. It's even got some pictures, which are often missing in our herbal books, when we read, especially in regards to medicine. I do like pictures because some of the plants I'm not real familiar with, and often plants have lookalikes. So misidentification can result in you mistaking our local gallberries for wild blueberries, and you're going to have a really surprising taste in your mouth when you're expecting blueberries. Gallberries happen to have acquired their name because they are as bitter as gall, and they are literally awful. Yeah, so once you taste them, you will learn to recognize the difference between the leaves of the plants because it's very, very subtle, and that's often the case, except some of them, I know that with local plants, some of them can be a toxic mistake in berries and whatnot. So what prompted you to decide to write this book?
Well, you know, I was actually running at the time, and a lot of good thoughts come when I'm out running in the woods or running on the road. And you know, I live and work herbal medicine every day, and we use hundreds of different plants in the clinic, and we study the subject from a modern perspective and a traditional perspective, and there's a lot of richness there, obviously. But what I think is often most impactful is to be able to simplify something a little bit and take a body of knowledge that's relatively complicated and distill it down to something that is, one can wrap one's head around fairly quickly. And that's one of the things that I've always loved about herbal medicine, is you can start, you know, eating dandelion roots, once you've got a positive ID for the plant, right away and get benefits from it right away. And you don't have to spend 30 years kind of trying to master the art, if one can even fully ever master the art. So I was running and I was thinking to myself, if you could really simplify herbal medicine, what is sort of most valuable and safest bare bones concept. And I started, you know, I've been thinking a lot about bitter plants. I don't know if necessarily as bitter as the gallberry you're talking about.
I hope not, because people them, talk about it and taking it.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are super bitter, like gentian root. It's very intense, and they have this amazing benefit in our digestion and in our liver function and helping with hypersensitivities to a range of different things, from food to pollen. But, you know, I knew how important these plants were, and I thought to myself also that another kind of plant that people would often use, especially for their mental health, and, you know, with all the stuff that we use in aromatherapy, all these plants that have a lot of strong scents to them, you know, and smells, and we use incense, and we use rose petals at weddings, and it got me thinking, like, wow, maybe these plants that have these strong smells are also really important, and they're really helpful for our spirits. And then, you know, I thought, because we've studied these plants a bunch, it's like, what about these tonic plants, the plants that really are very much like food and get deep down into every cell of our body, providing essential, you know, they're like meta vitamins. They're beyond just vitamin C or vitamin B. They're these trace chemicals, these phytochemical compounds that our cells really need, we're discovering, to function properly. And I said, wow, if you could just have a bitter plant, a plant that has strong smells, that is aromatic, and a tonic plant in your life, you would be employing the best of herbal medicine. It's fairly easy to understand. A lot of these plants are ridiculously easy to grow, and they're all really safe. And that made me think, this could be a really good, at least, way to bridge the gap between, you know, the herbalist who's studying hundreds of different plants and makes it their way of life, and the American consumer who's, you know, knows about local food and knows about produce, but hasn't really figured out the medicinal quality of a lot of the weeds that grow around them.
That's very true. I spent most of my life living on the desert. When I moved to the South, it was literally like moving to a foreign plant, our planet. I didn't recognize the trees, the grasses, all the plants were alien to me. And, you know, where I'd learned things from my grandparents and whatnot in an easygoing, informal way, all of a sudden, you know, when I was walking around and looking at things, I was stupid. I didn't know what anything was good for.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know.
You know, it's been an adult learning experience, which is entirely different for me, because none of the plants that grow here grow in the desert, obviously. You know, standing water just really doesn't happen on the desert very often.
Yeah, and probably very different from the ones that grow in Vermont, too. I bet I'd be semi-literate or semi-familiar with your floral landscape. But I'm so really familiar with the flora of the Northeast, and that's where a lot of these plants come from, though many of them are also more cosmopolitan, and they'll grow anywhere, you know, like dandelion. And some are really unique to tropical environments, like ginger, for instance. But, you know, I wanted to pick stuff that is, if it isn't easy to grow out in the garden or find in the wild, it's at least very easy to find in a grocery store. And we all can probably get a hold of some fresh ginger or a little bit of chocolate at a grocery store close by, and they're really very medicinal, and they're really very helpful, especially when we get them into our life habitually or every day.
So in this book, when you're talking about the various things you can do, is it more of a preventative concept, or is it more of a treating sort of ideology that is behind the book?
Well, the first thing I wanted to do was make sure they were safe plants. And that they could be used even in the context of whatever person might be putting into their body already, be it weird foods or different foods or pharmaceuticals or whatnot. But then beyond that, that's, I think, the beauty of herbal medicine is that you can use it preventatively and to address cardiovascular disease, for instance, that hasn't developed yet, but it's still useful even if there's a problem that's emerged.
Uh-huh.
I would say the first two classes of plants, the aromatics and the bitters, they do a lot to actually treat issues in the now, in the moment, and relatively quickly. Think about, you know, lavender even as a scent. You can use that internally as well, or lemon balm, a plant with a strong lemony scent. It has immediate effects on anxiety and immediate effects on mental tension. But when taken habitually over the long term, it makes it so that you don't experience that tension nearly as often. But if you're feeling tight, if you're feeling anxious, if you're feeling just a little frazzled and crazy, linden tea at the end of your day, it'll do the trick right then and there. And if you make a habit of it the way the French do, you know, in hot summers in Provence, then you'll generally have a much mellower life, it seems like.
Uh-huh. Well, it's definitely something that most of us could do with. I mean, you look at the political climate, the financial climate, the economic one, et cetera, that is all over America. And there's lots of reasons why people are very, very tense. And in some communities, you know, even just traveling within Mississippi here recently, I've noticed there are communities where the overall sense of tension is incredible, because I commented to my husband, it's like, oh, I hope we don't have to come back here. Everybody's like really wound tight. And, you know, you'll notice that sometimes entire areas are like that. So, you know, it's obviously something that the majority of the people could actually use as a way to unwind safely and legally, you know, without leaving them hung over the next day or whatever. And, you know, that taking that edge off can make a whole lot of difference. My own experiments with herbal medicine actually started when my daughter, who is now a mother herself, was an infant, and she developed some stomach bug, and every time she would suck on a bottle, she'd throw up. Well, obviously, she wasn't a stupid baby. She's like, oh, no, I don't want any part of that. She was fine from cup or spoon, but the bottle, I don't know what it was, why it was doing that to her at that time. But we had to do something with his nausea, because it took so much time to feed her with a cup and spoon. Yeah, it was much easier to get liquids down her if she could drink them out of a bottle. And, you know, an old lady said, give her peppermint tea. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was kind of desperate, so I thought, okay, it's got to be safe enough. I mean, we can drink it. It should be safe enough for a baby, so I gave her some. And miraculously, the problem went away. And yeah. So I used the mint tea anytime. You know, when her brother came along years later, if he had an upset stomach, he got mint tea too. Or when they were older, they got mint tea. Or if I had, you know, was upset, I don't even like mint, but it still would settle my stomach. Chamomile, same thing. It was calming. It wasn't like you were drugging the kid. It was like you were taking the edge off so that they would chill out, you know. And so I would use chamomile tea. And that was, I figured, okay, that's safe enough because, you know, we can drink them just as a food. And I think that's, you know, with a lot of people, they're comfortable with things that they're familiar with in terms of food, but anything too exotic, they kind of may look a little askance at.
Wow, gee, I mean, you bring up so many points right there, what you were saying. And, you know, one is the level of tension that people experience and that how prevalent that really is. And I think you're absolutely right. And what I'm trying to suggest is that it might be really difficult for us to run from that, given the culture and the way of the world now and the global nature of the world and the news cycle. You really can't hide from it, and it has these profound effects, you know, all the technologies we live with, the state of the world today. So what's crazy to me is that we've walked into this modern world, which, for all its craziness, also has some great advantages, but we've walked into it without the aromatic plants, the daily tea ritual, the things like the peppermint tea you gave your children, and that probably, you know, the teas that, you know, for example, my father gave me chamomile tea as I was growing up all the time, that are just part of this really, really old way of how human beings manage the tension in their lives. And the reason peppermint is so good for the belly is because it relaxes the belly, and that's what all these aromatic plants do. They relax our internal organs from the digestion to the arteries, and in so doing, the brain is relaxed as well. And the spirit is relaxed as well, because it's constantly checking in with what's going on in our tissues, viscerally, right? And humans have known this forever. They've given peppermint tea to their kids forever to relax their bellies and calm them down, too, in the process, right? The beautiful thing about aromatic plants is I don't know if you ever noticed this, but a lot of times, to kind of get going in the morning, a cup of peppermint tea will be really stimulating and invigorating. So while it relaxes the belly, it also can awaken the mind. And you think about smells and how they, you know, sometimes really wake us up and help us focus. That's the other benefit we see from aromatic plants. So we've walked into this modern world, which is crazy in many ways, and we've walked into it without these allies that we've known for hundreds of thousands of years, from before we were human beings, in fact. You know, I was just listening to this interesting piece about the medicinal use of plants by chimpanzees.
Uh-huh.
And, oh, yeah, it's very, very interesting stuff. I mean, they use it for dealing with digestive problems. They rub scented plants all over themselves, both to repel parasites and biting insects, but also, I think, you know, to smell good and calm down, kind of like perfume. Yeah, there's perfume again. Now, like, why do we use these things? They get into our mind and they awaken us through our sense of smell. And again, like, what you were doing for your kids is just exactly right. It's safe. It's food-like. It really is food. And we've kind of come to this point where we think of food as being this thing that maybe you get at a restaurant or through a grocery store that's packaged up and you pop in a microwave. And then anything that you're brewing or that comes from something that doesn't really have caloric value is weird and not really to be trusted or could be dirty or could be unsafe. And nothing could be further from the truth, really. It's just another kind of food that doesn't have caloric value, isn't carbohydrates or proteins or fats, but has really important ways of helping us cope with the world, a world we can't really escape, and a world that we have to learn to live in. Just for instance, again, recently, in the last year and a half, researchers discovered in Spain these Neanderthal skulls, and they scraped their teeth, and they found traces of chamomile in them. So, you know, these sites are 30,000 years old, and these people are eating these plants, which don't give them any nutritional value. Like, why are they doing it? Are they crazy? No. This stuff is helpful, and it's been part of us for a really long time.
That's interesting, you know, about chimpanzees as well as Neanderthals. You know, with the chamomile, I know that I'm not crazy about chamomile, but I have bought and drunk a lot of it over the years, simply because it is somewhat soothing, and it lacks caffeine and, you know, so forth and so on. So I would drink chamomile tea because it was supposed to be good for me. And, you know, did I ever develop a taste for it? Not really. I can tolerate it.
Well, let me tell you, I think the secret of brewing chamomile tea is to brew it for just about 90 seconds, at most 2 minutes, and then take the tea bag out. If you let it sit in there any longer, it turns really bitter. And sometimes that might be applicable, but many times it makes the tea really nasty. And what we used to do was brew it for just a couple of minutes. You know, we'd use 4 or 5 tea bags and use 1/2 gallon of water.
Uh-huh.
And then we would put a little bit of honey in it, take the tea bags out, put a little bit of honey in it while it was still warm, and then chill it in the freezer and drink it on ice. And it's really, really good. Really, really good. Soothing, refreshing, no bitterness.
I need to try that. Mississippi is a great place to encourage one to drink cold drinks. Something like May through October. Yeah, cold drinks are the thing. I mean, and most people here drink sweet tea. I happen to have a strong aversion to sweet tea. I mean, iced tea is fine, but when they add all that sugar, I to me it's just gross. I don't know why. I drink my coffee sweetened, but tea I just don't want sweetened for whatever reason. So, yeah, I do avoid the sweet tea that's so popular. And it's always funny going to a friend's house because the first thing they'll offer you just 9 out of 10 times in the South is sweet tea.
Yeah, hold the sugar a little bit, maybe.
More than a little bit. To me, it's syrupy sweet, and maybe it's because I did grow up drinking it without sugar. And
sure.
So then when you're confronted with it with sugar in it the first time, you're like, whoa! Yeah, but I never have developed a taste for a sweet tea, and I've been in the South for 10 years, I guess. Anyhow, apparently it's not something that's going to grow on me anytime soon. But, you know, the unsweetened teas and stuff like that, you know, yeah, I do like those. Or sometimes with herbal teas, I like those lightly sweetened, depending on what the tastes are like. So, you know, things like my daughter drinks a lot of ginger tea.
Yeah.
She's ginger root and makes either plain ginger tea or with something else in it. And she does that to help soothe an aggravated digestive system as well. Is that something, you know, is she on the right track, or did she just concoct
that? Oh, she absolutely is. It's interesting when you take, from an herbalist perspective, a plant like peppermint, and you compare it to a plant like ginger, they're both aromatic, right, and they have strong scents. Most herbalists, and probably anyone who's tasted these two plants, would be able to kind of say, well, peppermint kind of feels cool to me, and ginger feels kind of warm, or spicy, or hot, and peppermint feels like cool and menthol-y, you know?
Uh-huh.
And this is a really interesting traditional distinction. All the aromatic plants have a slightly different cocktail of chemicals in them that give them their smell. And they varied on in size, really. And the smaller chemicals are slightly more irritating to the tissue, so they kind of stimulate it a little bit. And then the larger chemicals generally tend to be more relaxing and persist a little bit longer. And having that 1-2 combination allows a plant to either taste a little more cool if there's a lot of smaller chemicals, or a little more warm if there's some of the larger chemicals and pungent compounds. And it also serves to alter their function a little bit, right? So where ginger will taste a little spicier, peppermint will feel a little more cool. But both, in the end, depending on the state of the body, can really help relax or stimulate digestive function. And what ginger does is it stimulates it a little bit. And so if you feel nauseous and your belly feels really full, ginger will help move its contents out and help relieve the nausea. Peppermint reduces spasm and contraction and loosens the stomach, making, you know, if things are feeling bloated and trapped, it also really helps. But they do it in slightly different ways, and they taste either cool or warm and spicy, depending on their chemistry. And an herbalist would say, like, well, you know, for a person whose circulation is poor, who needs a little bit of warmth, we might choose ginger to help relax the belly. But for a person, you know, who's already hot and shows us a lot of signs of redness in their face or on their tongue, we might choose peppermint to be a little more cooling. But you get to the same place with either plant, and you don't really have to overthink it, is the beauty of it. Since they're both aromatic plants, they're both going to have a relaxing effect on the belly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, ginger goes a little further because its chemistry, once it gets into the bloodstream, is also really good for things like arthritis, which is something that peppermint lacks. But that's kind of a special side effect. You know, you take it for your belly, and, well, look at that. Your hands feel a little less stiff in the morning when you wake up, and that knee feels a little bit better after a few months of drinking ginger tea.
Yeah, yeah. I'm strange when I have arthritis in my feet. I just, to me, it just seems like a strange place. I've never heard of anybody having it in their feet. So I have stiff feet. I guess if I'm going to have a stiff body part, having stiff feet is probably the least of all evils, I guess.
Hopefully they warm up, and at least it's not your back, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think I'd want it in my back. Because it is, you know, arthritis is stiffening. Now, when you're talking about herbalists and whatnot, a lot of people wouldn't understand what is the difference between an herbalist and somebody else. So what is exactly an herbalist?
Yeah, I mean, the way I usually encapsulate it is that herbalists are whole plant people. So they're folks who deal with foods that are plants, but also medicines that are plants. And these medicines are often really used unprocessed, you know, either just dried and brewed into tea, or, you know, about as fancy as we get is steeping the stuff in vodka and extracting it a little bit to make a tincture.
Uh-huh.
Or putting it into a capsule, but it's really unprocessed stuff. And herbalists do everything from, you know, walking out in the wild, collecting these plants, to growing them in gardens, to helping people figure out what plants might be useful in their life, very specifically. And some of them work at large manufacturing companies, contributing to the production of a small subset of the dietary supplements that you see in the grocery store shelf or in the natural food store shelf. About 18 to 20% of what we would call natural supplements, meaning not over-the-counter drugs or things like that. Everything from vitamins to, special homeopathic medicines. Out of all of that, herbal medicines are about 18 to 20%.
In my case, I know that I've bought many bottles over the years of cranberry extract, you know, concentrated cranberry in capsules, because it was just much easier than drinking gallons of cranberry juice or eating tons of cranberries, which is, in the South, it's a very seasonal thing. You can only buy them around the holidays in the winter, and that's it. You don't see them frozen or any other form after that. So for me, the cranberry pills, capsules, whatever, when I wanted to take them, that was the most efficient way to do so.
Yeah, and you know, that makes a lot of sense. And there are certain plants, I would say cranberry is one of the few, like cranberry, milk thistle seeds, saw palmetto, which is a berry that, I don't know if you have grown there in Mississippi, but certainly all over Florida, I think goes up into
Georgia, it grows all across the Gulf Coast, yeah.
I would bet, yeah. And something like turmeric root extract are pretty much the few that we will use in concentrated extracted form, because like you say, it's just way more convenient than drinking a gallon of unsweetened cranberry juice. But other than that, you know, we're really using teas or powdered herbs, and we're trying to get them as close as we can to, you know, right out of the ground. And the plants that I talk about in the book are ones that you can use that way, that you don't necessarily have to take so much of that you need a concentrated extract. But because of cranberry's effects, you know, on the urinary tract, being so mild when, you know, you just take a tablespoon of juice, it's not adequate. That's the kind of place where you have to do a concentrated cranberry extract. I think you're right about that.
It's been effective.
Mostly we try and use...
You still there?
Most of the time,
we
try to just use, we really just try to just use plants in their closest, most unprocessed whole form. And that was the thing that also got me thinking, you know, when I was writing this book, it's like, there's so many folks, especially up here in Vermont, but I think they're all over the country at this point, who are really, really into growing their own food, or at least buying food from farmers markets, or, you know, as locally as possible, both to support the local economy, but also because local food has got smaller of a carbon footprint, it hasn't been trucked all over, and it's just fresher and tastes better, right? So why are these folks purchasing big quantities of processed supplements, vitamins and multi-minerals and lots of very interesting things that you see on the market today that don't have a huge track record of use, are relatively new, and we don't know a lot about them. When we have all these, you know, local, fresh, wild medicinal plants that we could be using to accomplish a lot of the same stuff. So I was hoping that people who would be into local food systems and local production would also be into this kind of whole plant herbal medicine idea as a way to take care of their families and take care of their friends and take care of themselves.
Well, it makes absolute sense. I mean, and many people I know, you know, locally, they're very interested in using herbs in terms of treating at least minor illnesses. But when they needed to turn to a professional to address a more serious issue, you know, they're kind of at a loss, because where do you find a really well-trained herbalist? How do you know the difference between somebody who just grew some chamomile and decided, okay, I'm an herbalist?
Yeah, or, you know, took an online herbalism degree that lasts about 10 days and calls himself a master herbalist. I mean, that's a good question, but I think the answer actually is one of the great advantages of being, you know, of herbalism in the United States, and that is you don't know the difference. You got to learn to get to know your herbalist. And what that does is, again, it fosters, you know, let me tell you about this. When I started herbal medicine and practicing it actively, I had a small booth at my local Montpelier farmer's market. And, you know, I just gave that up a few years ago now because my life got a little too busy with teaching in clinic, but I loved it so much because every Saturday during the summer, which is short in Vermont, so, you know, I had it pretty easy, you get to connect with your community, and people get to ask you questions and see what's going on and see what you know about and see how you approach the plants and see what your advice does on the ground in the real world. And I think not having a credentialing system, which herbalism lacks in this country, think some of the only countries, you know, in what we would call the quote-unquote developed world where herbal medicine isn't somehow regulated or licensed. That fact makes it so that you really have to get to know the person you're working with. And I really like that. I also worked for a while at a local organic farm. And he was organic. You know, we grew everything organically. But the farmer there, Alan, he refused to get certified. He said, listen, if you don't want to get to know me and see my soil and see what I do, then I don't know if you want to buy food from me regardless of my certification or not. Being a small-scale local farmer entails connecting with your community, right?
Right.
And what we lack so much, I think, in healthcare is deep connection to the community. We used to have that when country docs would travel around, you know, and watch kids mature into parents, mature and have the kids of their own, really know the family, really know the community. But that doesn't really happen anymore in the modern healthcare setting. There's little pockets of it, maybe, but the conventional medical system isn't set up that way. But what we have are these plant people who know a lot about the stuff that grows locally and know how to connect with folks in really deep and meaningful ways. And so approaching an herbalist, you know, definitely people should know more about plants so they can just use the safe stuff daily for prevention. And then if you need more, like you say, you've got to find someone who maybe has a little more knowledge of the local flora and how to use it medicinally. And you have to develop a relationship with them. And that takes work, I know, but it totally is worth it in the end. And it strengthens the community, and it strengthens the ecological bonds between the people using the medicine, the herbalist, and the natural world. And that just spirals into, you know, positive quality for the community. And so that's why I really, I'm excited for the people to really become a part of the healthcare team, because that will encourage people to take more personal responsibility and more community-based responsibility for health and well-being. And that's just going to make everybody stronger.
You know, I listen to what you're talking about, the healthcare system. You know, in general, I would say that I'm not enthusiastic and I tend to avoid it. But a little over a month ago, my husband had a serious heart attack and was hospitalized for a week. And then, of course, it means follow-up appointments with a cardiologist. And we had the first appointment with the cardiologist in this really huge clinic. And you felt like you were just a cog in a machine. And nobody's really listening to what you're saying, or so you feel. They did apparently listen to some of what we were saying because they called today to change the medication. But, you know, you do. You don't feel very human. You feel like just one more object being processed on this conveyor belt. And it's not very personal at all.
Yet at the same time, you know, probably helped save your husband's life.
Right.
And that, we need to acknowledge how valuable that intervention is, right? But look at the aftercare and look at the lack of sort of pre-care from that. You know, I'm really sorry to hear that about your husband.
It was unusual. I mean, he wasn't
scary.
He wasn't in any group that would normally be labeled as high risk.
Right.
You know, and yet he did have a serious heart attack and was hospitalized a long time. And now the side effects that he's suffering from happen to be from too much of one medication. In his case, it's blood thinners. And now, you know, his blood has turned into pretty much water. So, you know, it was a case of the lack of communication resulted in this overdose that's been going on for some time now. And, you know, it's because people forget they're dealing with humans. We don't know what the nurses and doctors know, and if they don't tell us, then we're going to do exactly what they told us to, you know? And that turned out to be the wrong thing because they assumed we knew.
And so, you know, Gio, what if you guys had in your community or down your street someone who kind of knew what the warning signs were and knew what an overdose of warfarin might look like and was in kind of like, you know, close connection with you and your family? and
that
was
you didn't
able
have to wait 6 weeks to see.
Right, but also was in communication with the medical system, and that's really what herbalists
right.
do, right? That's what we do in our clinic. We get to know people in our community, and we also have great relationships with the primary care providers in the modern medical and technological medical system. And we're able to bridge that gap, and it's this huge problem, like you say, waiting 6 weeks, right? Why? Because no one wants to go into primary care medicine anymore. It doesn't pay. You can't pay your loan. It's not as prestigious. Everyone looks down at you. No one wants to be a country doc anymore. They all want to be, you know, high-powered neurosurgeons.
In my case, I travel over 100 miles to see a doctor because for the first time in my adult life, I happen to click with one who is a general practitioner. He also happened to come from a very similar background in the same part of the country I grew up in. Which is weird because we're both in Mississippi, and neither one of us, we happen to both come from northern Iowa. Most people from northern Iowa don't live in Mississippi, you know. So just the fact that our families knew each other and we ran into each other, you know, 30-some years later was kind of odd because I didn't realize it. I'd been seeing him for a year and a half before I found out that he'd even come from the same area, let alone that we, our families knew each other.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you found a good person. And there's tons of good people out there. They're just few and far between because there's not that many primary care providers. So we need an alternative. And I'm not waiting around to train more docs because it's just not happening. So what I'm doing is training herbalists, right? And then I also want to train the general public to use these plants more. And if that happens and more personal responsibility is taken, then we can take a big burden off the system. That's why I always say, you know, herbalism heals more than just individual people. It's healing the system of healthcare, too. It's bringing these allies back into our lives, and these plants that have been walking with us, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years, and we just turned our backs on them, you know, less than 100 or 200 years ago at most. Some people, I would say, not even 40 or 50 years.
Well, I know in my own case, you know, there a number of the plants that grew on the Sonoran Desert or the High Plateau in Arizona, I was familiar with their medicinal use. I've used Mormon tea for colds. It works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there were other plants that you could use, either as food or whatever, medicine and stuff. And you just knew, I mean, when you walked around, you knew what that plant was called in probably more than one language. And mm-hmm. you also knew what it told you. Which people, a lot of people assume that I'm talking, I'm hearing voices from plants in my head. That's not what I mean by what the plant told you. Plants tell you a lot about climate, how recently the soil's been disturbed, about other things that grow in the area, about altitude, about the amount of rainfall, recent rainfall, you know, as well as the average rainfall in the year. It tells you all sorts of things. And, you know, I don't know if that dialogue is as distinct as it in the Northwest as it was in the, or Northeast as was in the Southwest. And that kind of dialogue is much different, I know already, in the South. Because there's not a whole lot of altitude and rain differences going on here.
I'm so glad you bring that up, Gia, because I think it's a great bit of wisdom about connection to the plant world. And we do have, definitely the biosphere changes as you move up to elevation, and we don't have the elevation that you see in the Sonoran Desert, but, you know, our top mountains get up to 4,500 feet at most around these parts. And you get a huge excursion all the way up to a tundra-like rocky outcropping at the top through birch trees and spruce trees and then to, the mountain ashes of elevation and then finally down to the maple forest and the hemlock trees. And the understory changes as well, so I know exactly what you mean about that, about how plants speak to us in very literal ways about the environment and the weather and the history of the landscape. But what's really neat from an herbalist perspective, from someone who's used to eating these plants, is that they speak to us about the quality of the environment deep within ourselves, too. It's like our cellular processes, our ears, and the words that plants use are plant chemicals. And you start to see in the way the plant chemicals interact with our immune cells, in the way they interact with the unfolding of DNA and genetic material inside our cells, that they're able to relay, and this is, to me, one of the greatest examples. These plants make compounds called bioflavonoids.
plants like blueberries and cranberries are loaded with them, but you also see them in plants like goldenrod. And they change the amount and the type of bioflavonoids they make depending on the environmental conditions through the summer, through the seasons in which they're growing. And if humans who live around there eat them, they alter the way the human cells express themselves. Basically, if there's a drought and the plant produces more quercetin, for instance, a type of bioflavonoid, we will start to change our genetic processes so that our metabolic rate will slow down, we'll start to conserve energy, our cells will last longer and be able to withstand, you know, the harsh effects of living in an environment that is experiencing drought. So they don't only talk to our five visual senses, they also talk to cellular processes and metabolic processes in our body, helping us to deal with and adapt with the environment around us better. It's as if the environment is a being, right? And plants are one organ of this being, and people are another organ of this being. And the plant chemicals are hormones that the different organs use to talk to each other. I don't know if that analogy makes sense. But we can consume them, we can commune with these plants, and they are really actually changing the way our physical being unfolds to make it most adaptable and most successful in dealing with the environment that it is experiencing.
That's you know, yeah, I can see where that would definitely be true. And that makes me question, you know, is there a difference in the actual food value that is found in food that's grown in healthy soil with organic fertilizers and whatnot versus the food that comes off of one of these agribusiness farms that have been doused with numerous chemicals?
Yeah, I mean, that's a complicated question. So first and foremost, the plant like a tomato or a romaine lettuce or a broad bean, whether it's grown organically or conventionally, it's very new in terms of the type of plant that it is. It's not been around for long. We've hybridized it over the last 150 years into what it is today. And some of them have taken longer. You know, corn has probably been a 15,000-year hybridization process from the original plant that was the progenitor of corn. But regardless, genetically and evolutionarily speaking, these are relatively new plants that we're growing. Now, it was recently found by, I think, the University of Stanford research team that organic food, on average, when sampled, doesn't necessarily have a lower nutritional content, just like straight-up vitamins, for example, minerals, than agribusiness conventionally grown food. But there have been other studies that have found the exact opposite. So I think, you know, at the risk of sounding unhelpful, the jury's not entirely out on whether organic food is more nutritious. But what we do know is that the non-food plants, the plants that are still unhybridized, which basically are herbal medicines, those plants are loaded with a range of different chemicals that are really not found in our modern fruits and vegetables. And I really think that it is these that our bodies are missing. Certainly, it's really important to get those basic vitamins, you know, like vitamin C and the B vitamins, on carotenoids or vitamin A. It's really important to get those, and you get them in huge amounts from eating produce and fruits. But I really think we need a range of different chemicals as well, the ones that are found in much greater abundance in wild plants, and they don't really taste super good to us. You know, they taste a little bitter, they don't taste quite right. But without bitter chemicals, for instance, our liver doesn't really work right, and we can't detoxify the stuff that the modern world is throwing at us quite as well. We tend to get more hypersensitive and more allergic to things, and our digestion is totally messed up. So, I don't know. I personally really only try and consume organic food, and I definitely grow everything that I grow organically. But I also grow all these medicinal plants, right? And that having that in my daily life, I think, really makes a huge difference. And if you've got a garden and you like growing stuff organically, grow some medicine plants, too. They'll connect you to your environment and to what's going on there. If there's toxicity there, they'll help you detoxify it. If there's toxicity in the air, they'll be tasting the same air that you're tasting, and they will help you handle it better. And, you know, beyond that, lots of fruits and vegetables, and as fresh as possible. You will do really well.
Well, that makes sense. But it is time for us to take a break. So, folks, hold on to your keyboard and don't move a muscle. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back with more conversation with Guido Massey.
Thank you. If you are listening to the show and wish to join us in the chat room, visit paltalk.com. Go to the social issues, select Other, and enter the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Breaking news! Strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth! People are exhilarated! I'm scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down! My God! My God! They're beaming me up with them! Don't put that probe there! Don't put that probe there! Don't put a... The, ooh! 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 Listen to the Judge of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchard, bringing you The High Strange. Visit www.judgeofmabusradio.com. That's www.judgeofmabusradio.com.
Red wine, you'll never feel so grand. I feel $1 million when you're just in the hand. Red wine, you'll never feel so sad. Anytime I see you go, let me feel your bad. Red wine, I love you like that.
Whippazine, woolly whippazine, I'm gonna do my own thing. Red wine, in a ghetto style. Red wine, in a modern day style. Yeah.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hey, hi there. Got your attention? I'm Gia Scott, and I was curious what you were doing from 7 to 9 p.m. Central Time on Tuesdays. See, I host this really interesting little radio program that airs live then, and we bring in all sorts of guests. Authors, experiencers, and everything in between. It's paranormal and guaranteed to make you go, hmm. My guest list is always up at www.giascott.com, and do tune in to the Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays.
Hello, everyone. I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and along with my co-host, Victor the Voice Furman with Second Sight NYC. Hey, Victor, who's our guest this week?
Chris, our guest this week is Richard Southall, paranormal investigator and author of the book, Haunted Route 66, Ghosts of America's Legendary Highway.
Well, Victor, I'm going to come pick you up with my convertible caddy. You're going to jump in. We're going to go get our kicks on Route 66.
I can dig it, baby.
Well,
tune in to the Mind Cemetery with your hosts Chip and Nicole every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We delve into UFOs, abductions, ghosts, aliens, conspiracies, and cryptozoology.
And how could you ever forget about those creepy topics you won't hear on your local news?
This is where I would insert my obligatory skeptical statement. The Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest.
Follow us on Twitter and subscribe to us on Facebook. Also, check us out on our website, mindcemetery.com, for show updates and the critically acclaimed Mind Cemetery blog.
It's not critically acclaimed, but you should check it out anyway, mindcemetery.com.
Hi, everybody. This is Erica Getch. I hope to see you on Friday at 8 p.m. Pacific on the Galactic Connection, keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and tonight we are talking with Guido Massey about his book, The Wild Medicine Solution, Healing with Aromatic, Bitter, and Tonic Plants. Guido, you know, before we went on break, we were talking about, you know, the difference in between organic and conventionally grown food plants. So, you know, if there's not much difference that they've been able to measure so far between the two, is there a difference, say, perhaps between heirlooms and some of the modern hybrids? Especially right now, the hot topic is GMOs.
Yeah, I would definitely say that if you're aiming for a more nutritionally rich experience in your meal, the heirloom varieties are probably the way to go. And that, I think, is probably more important even than the way you grow it in terms of nutrition, let's say. Before we talk about GMOs, which I think are definitely an interesting issue, without a doubt, well, I wanted to at least mention the idea that one of the big differences with organic cultivation of food is what types of chemistry it releases into the environment. And if only for that reason, choosing organic is probably a smart thing to do. The residues that are found may be negligible, especially if you wash your produce, but there's a lot of pesticide and herbicide that's released into the groundwater and into the air and into the soil in our country and beyond from conventional agriculture that organic agriculture really lacks. And those types of particularly pesticides, which are neurotoxins, but also herbicides, which have been linked to birth defects, not particularly good for us in the long term, and farm workers who have to apply them end up getting really sick.
Everybody assumes that farm life is such a healthy life. Farmers, in fact, have a higher rate of cancer and other chemically accelerated types of diseases
because of
their continual exposure to herbicide pesticides.
So, you know, if only for that reason, organic agriculture, I think, is hugely advantageous to us as a species and to our environment. But the thing about genetically modified food is that it's, you know, fairly rapid acceleration in the natural hybridization process that we've been doing for tens of thousands of years. You know, we would breed plants, and we change them as we breed them, and, you know, the beefsteak heirloom tomato that is no good for shipping but is nutritionally awesome has made way for this, you know, thick-skinned, watery, not very nutritious, pink commercial tomato. And that process has taken a certain amount of time, but the idea of being able to genetically modify food has taken that hybridization process and, you know, put the pedal to the metal and really accelerated it in a way that we've never seen before. And, you know, I think that's great. You know, if you want to genetically modify organisms, especially in a laboratory setting, I think a lot of good things have come of it. For example, we've been able to synthesize substances such as insulin, or not synthesize, but basically grow them by genetically modifying E. coli in huge vats and isolating the insulin they produce by taking human genes and putting them into bugs. And that's hugely beneficial. You know, people used to grind up the pancreases of pigs to get insulin, and it was a huge problem for diabetics. But what kind of gets to me is that the modification of basic food staples like corn or soybeans, and now we're starting to talk about famine and stuff like that, is released into the environment. Very different from, you know, getting insulin out of E. coli in a vat in an industrial production facility. And what we've generally found when we release the products of technology into the environment really quickly is that 15, 20, 30 years later, we come back and we say, like, oh, whoops, let's kind of not do that anymore because there's this new issue we discovered with this thing, and I know everybody's been using it, and we've been giving it to our babies for the last 30 years and spraying it on our kids in the streets, but actually it's really bad, and let's not use that anymore. We've got this new thing that's good. And then another 30 years later, the cycle repeats itself. And I'm afraid that's going to happen with a lot of these genetically modified foods that we're releasing into the environment. And we'll see the same thing that happened not only with DDT, but also with drugs such as Vioxx, which were found to cause heart attacks after 5 or 10 years of study. And I always discourage people from being necessarily early adopters of food and medical technology, because we tend to be way overzealous letting this stuff out into the public, and a lot of the negative effects take time to develop, and sometimes they take generations to develop, right? And I think we need to be just a little more cautious and a little more forward-thinking, the way perhaps some of our ancestors were, in thinking a few generations down the line about our current decisions today. And I really think that genetic modification of food organisms on industrial scales taking up large swaths of the country is going to be something that we'll come back to later and say that wasn't such a good idea because this happened or that happened. So, again, I can't really say what that is, and it's unclear right now, but every time we have accelerated our process of progress and released that into the general environment too soon, we've generally had bad consequences. I think one of the best examples of the way we approach these was the story of penicillin, right, which is this new substance for Alexander Fleming in the 20s, and then it's finally mass-produced industrially in the 1940s after World War II. And, you know, people say, like, wow, we've conquered infectious disease with this substance, penicillin. And you know, scientists at that time were at least thinking ahead enough to say, wow, I wonder if bacteria will develop a resistance to this new drug that we have, this penicillin that we just invented. And, you know, some of the buddies looked around the table and said, yeah, you know, they might, but it's going to take like 200 years. And in fact, it took 5 years. So, you know, for the first penicillin-resistant strain bugs to start emerging. And now we know that penicillins don't work on a huge range of common bacteria and common types of staph, and it's getting to be a real problem. So, again, unfortunately, it's a pattern that has repeated itself over and over again, and I just fear that it might happen again with these genetically modified organisms released into the wild.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of people don't realize that we have a long list of heirloom varieties of crops such as wheat, soybeans, corn, oats, etc., that are now extinct, nearly extinct, or endangered. And when we lose this genetic variety in the future, if we have any problems with disease, pests, lack of viability, whatever, if we don't have that gene pool to draw from, we might be in a world of hurt in terms of food production.
Yeah, I think you make a hugely important point, and that's generally the nature of life, right? Diversity encourages resiliency, and monoculture tends to expose us to risk. And I think that that's, you know, if we think of ourselves as a garden, we've kind of been doing that to ourselves, too. Not only have we been cutting down on the variety of heirlooms, which exposes us to the risks you rightly point out in terms of threats to our food supply. But we also have gone from, you know, 100 to 150 different species that supplied 80% of our calories at the turn of the 20th century to 8 species that supply 80% of our calories at the turn of the 21st century. So our internal gardening, you know, what we're nourishing ourselves with,
has also dramatically dropped in terms of biodiversity. And corn, wheat, and soy are at the top of that, and it's all industrial corn, wheat, and soy. It's not, you know, the old Flintham Park heirloom varietal. And I think that a lot of the digestive, obesity-related, diabetes-related problems we experience come in part from this lack of biodiversity and the removal of these signal molecules that the plants are trying to talk to us with in favor of something that lends itself to being produced easily and cheaply, trucked long distances, and stored on shelves for long periods of time.
Yeah. You know, and you know, trying to encourage people to eat a bigger variety of plants and eat some of these plants that have not been civilized as much. You know, earlier on in the program you did mention that often they taste very odd to us. You know, we've sort of trained our palates to only like certain flavors. And these bitter flavors or extremely bland flavors, sometimes it's a texture. You know, for people that have never sampled wild foods, sometimes they taste very strange to us or feel very strange to be chewing up because they are different in textures. I mean, there's a huge difference between the wild carrot and the kind of carrots I bought in a bag at the grocery store yesterday.
Oh, yeah. To say the least, it is a super huge difference. But, you know, up until, I mean, some would say 50, but definitely 150 years ago, maybe not in terms of the wild carrot, but in terms of most of the food we were eating, it was still a lot more unhybridized and relatively wild and not quite as good. And, you know, I generally think that most of the individuals I've met are really smart, right? Most people are really, you know, have good common sense and are relatively intelligent. But get us together as a group and we act like toddlers. It's nuts. So basically, as a culture, we've basically had our hand in the cookie jar for the last 150 to 200 years, and we've just been eating out of it. And we've not eaten any of the regular stuff that makes us healthy and keeps us healthy. And it really makes sense to me, you know, for most of human development, evolutionarily, we've been working really hard all the time and eating this stuff that doesn't taste so good and has got a lot of fiber and roughage in it, and, you know, it certainly isn't cake. And industrialization in the 1800s gave us the opportunity to sit down and rest and eat cake all the time. And we ran with that, we really did. And I can see why, you know, it's a lot easier and tastier. But what I think we figured out that sitting on your butt all day doesn't really work out. It's not good for us to be sedentary as a species. Movement is important, not only if you want to just stay fit and healthy, but also if you have a condition like arthritis. You know, it won't do you good to just put your feet up all day. Your feet are going to get more stiff if you do that, right?
Oh, yeah, I spend a lot of time on mine doing flexing exercises. Even like right now where I am sitting down talking to you, I notice I keep flexing my feet, you know, all the time. And that's because I know I've got to keep them moving or they're going to become very stiff. And, you know, maybe it's time that we kind of look at our diet. I mean, for anybody who's ever tried some of these foods, even recreated from recipes during America's colonial period, these foods taste strange. They're often very bland to us because they don't have the salt and sugar that we're accustomed to all our food being laced with. They have a lot more fiber, so they feel strange in your mouth. I mean, if you've ever tasted bread made from, I almost forgot the name of it now, it's a tree that grows in Arizona on the desert. But they make the mesquite bean. You can make a bread out of it. And it's nothing like what we would call bread, okay? It's not real appetizing. Even some of the Native American foods. I remember trying a corn cake. The corn cake lasted me all day because every time somebody tried to hand me another one, I held up the one I'd been gnawing on all day. Did it taste good to me? No. It was flavored with juniper ashes. It tasted like ashes. Did I like it? not really. Was it good for me? Very possibly. I mean, juniper ash has probably had a lot of trace minerals in it, and that was what it was used to flavor the cornmeal bread.
Yeah, they're salty, too. They're salty, you know.
Oh, not to the modern palate. They didn't taste salty.
Oh, no. Yeah, I know. Not salty.
But, yeah, you know, and that's the thing, is that the modern palate has been trained to seek out the high fat, high sugar, high salt foods, because, yeah, I guess, you know, in our ancient times, those were
desirable. They're hugely rewarding to us. They give us a drug-like rush, you know. Kessler, this former FDA commissioner, wrote a book on how food industry uses our drug-like reaction to sugar and salt and fat to literally hook us on these processed foods. And it's because you couldn't ever really find that stuff. And it was hugely, hugely important. Without fat, we don't have good brain development. Without carbohydrate, we really can't maintain energy to keep foraging. And without salt, our electrolyte balance gets totally screwed up. So anytime our tongue tasted these things, our brain got a rush. And we would get it very rarely, right, in sort of a more paleolithic context. What we got all the time was bitterness. And bitterness, you know, from things like that, juniper ashes that those corn cakes were flavored with, but also from, you know, a wild carrot root or some other kind of tuber you might have dug up. It really is the cue to the body that it's got to wake up and deal with whatever put into its mouth. It could be poisonous. It could be toxic. It's definitely enlivening. It may not taste good, but it is what the body uses as a cue that something has been ingested. Never could you consume something carbohydrate-rich without also having something bitter accompanying it. And I think the modern carrot is still an example of that. Try and eat carrot peel. You know, it's bitter. So what do? We peel them. I don't suggest doing that. Definitely eat the peel. But the beauty of it, of herbal medicine, I think, Gia, is that, you know, you can eat the foods that modern culture brings us, but you eat just tiny amounts of these bitter wild plants, and you can handle them a whole heck of a lot better. So you don't have to, like, make corn cake your staple and never touch a plate of pasta again. You definitely can eat cake and refined carbohydrates, you know, obviously in moderation, if you consume something bitter with it. And the beauty of the bitter, you know, is that it stimulates substances in our body, like the stuff called polypeptide Y, which when their levels of polypeptide Y are higher in the bloodstream, people presented with an all-they-can-eat buffet eat about 30% less. 30%, that's a lot, right? And the reason is that the bitter taste awakens our digestive function and gets us to a point of feeling full more quickly, while at the same time stimulating all our digestive juices, encouraging liver detoxification pathways, helping us handle what we eat. But none of the food we have has anything bitter in it anymore, right? And so I don't think the problem is the sweet and the salty and the fatty. You know, we can handle this stuff. We can only handle it if we also have the bitter flavor along with it that tells our digestion to wake up, detoxify the stuff, balance our blood sugar, and improve liver function. It's pretty remarkable, and, you know, if you want the clearest example of this, get something bitter, like even just a dried up dandelion root or a fresh dandelion root. Put it in your pocket before you go to the grocery store. If you're like me, a lot of times you go to the grocery store when it's, you know, 5:30, you just picked up your kids from school, and it's the end of your day, and maybe you have to go get something to be able to actually even prepare a meal or make breakfast and lunch for the kids next morning. And when you walk into the grocery store and you're hungry, you know, they know this. They put the chips and, you know, special cookies right there up front for you, and often they find your way in the basket. That's because it's this deep-rooted, I would say primal and almost reptilian carbohydrate reward craving drug-like response. If you chomp down on some of that dandelion root before you walk in the door, the bitter flavor will counteract the low blood sugar you're experiencing that is driving you to seek out sweet, salty, and processed foods. And it will give you 30 to 45 minutes of sort of relief from the grasp that the sugar has on us. I jokingly write in the book that, you know, we are slaves of the grasses, and basically corn has taken us over and turned us into a slave race that is devoted to cultivating huge sections of our prime wild land in favor of corn. And
you know, from a dispassionate, you know, if a spaceship came down and took a snapshot of planet Earth, you know, I think they'd say, like, which organism is really in charge here? They've got all of their infrastructure devoted to growing and shipping and eating this stuff, and huge, huge sections of the planet are devoted and set aside to the family, the Poaceae, the family of the grasses, from rice to corn to wheat.
That's very, very true. You know, and it feeds a lot of people, and that's a good thing. But before we consume it, it's usually processed to the point where a lot of the, you know, so-called good-for-us parts have been taken away. White rice is much more common than brown rice. Even though it's more processed, it costs more than to buy brown rice or unprocessed rice than it does to buy plain old white rice. The same thing for white flours or processed cornmeal and so forth and so on. The more processed forms are the least expensive forms.
Yeah, true, and that's probably a function of the economy of scale, you know, because everyone's eating the processed stuff, and that's what the machinery is geared towards producing. And what is it that they remove? They remove the bitter and the fibrous. And so when we eat the plate of white rice, our body doesn't even really know that we've eaten anything. And so the stuff gets in our gut, it starts to ferment, we get bloated, et cetera, et cetera. But really, you know, my point is in the book that if you incorporate bitter plants while you eat this refined stuff, you basically don't experience bad effects from it as much because, A, you're digesting it more completely, and you're actually telling your body that you're eating something, so it's harder to overeat, and you don't get, you know, undigested material that is fermenting and bloating anymore. But B, you're also helping your liver detoxify any residues of modern conventional agriculture, be it pesticide or herbicide, that might be found on that food. Or
maybe the South's traditional fondness for bitter greens might not be such a bad thing then.
Not at all.
I can remember the first time I tasted collard greens, I thought, I can't believe people eat these on purpose. Now I like them too, which is frightening because I didn't used to. You know, and some of the greens that are hugely popular in this region really do have a bitter taste.
And you'll see that in every culture around the world, right? It's no sort of coincidence that bitters are put into cocktails. And in Italy, where I grew up, they make special bitter liqueurs, you know, like Fernet Branca and Cynar and even Campari. They're part of almost every meal. You know, you take a little bit of bitter a little bit before or a little bit after your meal. And again, bitter greens in Ethiopian cuisine and the cuisine of India and the cuisine of China. And again, exactly like you say, good collards cooked up in some nice local organic pork fat. It's just amazingly, amazingly good, even though it is a little bit of an acquired taste. But, you know, the general fast food aisle there, you know, in the strip mall strip, don't have anything like that, really. And that's, I think, a big part of the issue. And I guess if McDonald's stocked collard greens across the country, we'd probably see a little bit of improvement in general health of the population.
Somehow I don't think it'd be met with great enthusiasm, though, having remembered my own initial. And even when I was younger and my grandparents would be eating mustard greens or collard greens or turnip greens, those three to me are the most bitter of the greens, I didn't like them. I would usually avoid them, whereas I liked the kale and the spinach and the chard, which are less bitter, but the really, really bitter ones, I was like, oh, yuck. You know, and I thought it was very strange that they liked these bitter-tasting greens.
You know what I'll say is that that's usually the initial reaction people have to exercise, too. If people would actually do this, but we know, you know, just like doing stretches and limbering exercises for your feet, we know that it's really important to do that for our bodies. And so things that taste bitter and these bitter greens that are embedded in traditional cultures, there's a reason for this. Is it's exercise for our digestion. And without it, our digestion and our liver detoxification pathways and our blood sugar balancing apparatus, it just doesn't work right. And so what do you see? You see a rise in overeating,
You see a rise in blood sugar problems, and you see a rise in inflammatory disease that is associated with poor liver function. So again, you know, it's plant deficiency syndrome, really. We shouldn't call it metabolic syndrome or cardiovascular disease. The biggest killer in the Western culture is plant deficiency syndrome.
I find it interesting. My granddaughter, who's 2.5 now, absolutely adores collard greens. I mean, she will go through a bowl of them and nothing flat. And, you know, I find it strange. It's a bitter-tasting plant. She prefers it to something like green beans, or heaven forbid, she will not eat peas if her life depends on it, which I sympathize with her there. I'm not crazy about peas myself. So, you know, it's interesting to see her food preferences. She doesn't live with me. She doesn't know her grandma despises peas, too. Because we always grew up with a theory that you didn't exhibit food dislikes in front of children so that they didn't catch them, because they are contagious in that way. If they see that the people they admire, respect, or attach to have an aversion to a food, guess what? They don't like it either. So that's, you know, that's an important thing. Yeah.
You know, if they see people they respect and admire eating certain foods habitually, then, you know, they develop a liking of them. And I have a little bottle of bitters that I use in seltzer, you know, while I'm cooking. And I'll always make a little drink for my daughter, too, while we're cooking together. I mean, she'll drink bitters, you know, it's like gentian root and dandelion root. God, awful stuff. And, you know, she developed a taste for it. And at this point, you know, she'll ask me while we're cooking, like, hey, can I have a little drink with bitters, too? It is good for you, and it's not only good for you, it's kind of a birthright of humans, and it's a part of us, and it's an extension of us, and we really miss it if we don't have that bitter flavor, just like our bodies miss it when they stop moving and when we don't get walking, exercise, and outside breathing fresh air, and, you know, being in a place where there are green plants growing. Not only being out there, but also having them in us, it's really an important way to keep us healthy, and also deal with problems, especially the problems associated with modern life, you know, problems related to digestion and blood sugar balance and toxicity, toxic exposure, problems with the aromatic plants related to spiritual health, mental health, and that sort of universal feeling of fear and satisfaction that you see in this culture a lot, that tension that you were talking about.
This tension actually gives way to a lot of other things, because it creates short tempers, abrasiveness, rudeness, you know, and these things lead to acts of violence. I mean, if you can't be angry, you're much less likely to do something that hurts someone else. So to address these issues might be addressing some of the underlying issues in our own culture.
Well, I unfortunately have to agree with you. You know that part of, again, the rise in any kind of senseless violence acts is a symptom of, on a cultural level, that same dissatisfaction and lack of focus and lack of something to kind of hang your dreams on. We're somewhat rudderless, I would say, in terms of spiritual and emotional maturity in this culture. And I know that's kind of insulting and harsh thing to say, considering how many people are really deeply spiritual. But at the same time, there's this satisfaction and this restlessness that so many feel. And I can understand why. It's a crazy world. There's so much information. It moves at such a fast pace. It's really, really difficult for us to adapt. And we always feel like we're missing something or losing something. And we don't know quite even what that is. And if we would just slow down and you know, breathe in a fragrant garden and sit with some lavender and some lemon balm and maybe even make tea out of those plants, I think we'd find just a little bit more reconnection and a little bit of respite. And like you say, culturally, we might have a little less tendency towards this tension-based, fear-based, reactive violence. And again, our kids will see this. This is multi-generational work we're talking about. It can help us in the short term, or it can really help us is over the course of two generations. You know, it's taken us at least that long to get into the mess we're in today.
And you can do it in a kind of fun way. You know, you've been talking about gardening and plants and aromatics. Fun project I did a very long time ago now with my kids was we built a raised bed. Well, actually, it was more of a sunk bed because we lived on the high plateau then, so sinking it rather than raising it was the goal, to hold water. But it was a hand of time, is what we called it. And it was a very large handprint in the backyard in which we planted not only thyme but a number of other herbs, complete with red-blooming salvia for fingernails because we had to have painted fingernails on our hand, right?
Whoa, nice.
It was fun. It was whimsical. The only people that could truly appreciate this giant-sized hand, because it was probably from fingertip to wrist, it was probably 10 feet, which isn't super giant-sized, but it's a good size for most people's backyard. We lived near the airport at that time, and probably the planes that flew overhead, which were mostly slurry bombers, for people who are familiar with forest fires, they got to, you know, get the bird's eye view of our hand of time. But it was whimsical. It was fun. It was something that, you know, kept on giving for a long time because most of these plants were perennials and just needed some tending. We even had rosemary in the wrist. Yeah.
Okay. That sounds fantastic. And, you know, not only is it useful for cooking and useful for medicine, and the line between cooking and medicine obviously is very thin, but it also got you and it got your kids outside, right? And we're starting to see more and more.
There's a connection with the earth that you feel when you're gardening that you don't.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and just strolling around. Now, we would reconnect with the earth in a different way because we did spend a lot of time in the forest. My kids had ADD, and I've been told I do too, but anyhow. By connecting with the forest, by going out on, at that time we lived in Arizona, it was the Mogollon Rim, we'd go out on the rim a couple times a month at least. And it didn't matter what we did, but it kept my son at the time, was the younger one, and it kept him on an even enough keel the school quit screaming to have him medicated.
Yeah.
And that's a huge difference between, you know, that level of being able to concentrate and your mother, you know, fending off demands for medication. You know, it made a difference.
You know, Gia, that they've actually clinically researched that phenomenon that you're describing, and they took kids and they divided them into groups, and they were kids who had ADD diagnoses. And to one group, they gave 30 minutes, just 30 minutes of walking in a park in a city, so not even, you know, the Sonoran forest. And they found that equivalent to one dose of Ritalin in terms of helping with the symptoms and helping with focus and calming the children down. And, you know, to me that's a no-brainer, right, what the answer is.
Yeah, I mean, we would come up with all kinds of excuses to go out and do it. In spring we would go antler hunting for spring shed elk antlers, which at that time you could get like $10, $20 a pound. Well, obviously, one antler was worth a substantial amount when gas was less than a dollar a gallon. You know, finding one antler in 8-10 hiking trips was enough to pay for the hiking trips. You know, and, that, yep. And that's literally something that we would, you know, one excuse to go out there. You know, and in addition to the calming down effect, you know, the kids learned all sorts of things from, you know, safety when you're hiking to plants that grew out there, to the animals, to how you can get closer to elk without scaring them off before you even saw them, to don't get close to bears. Big advice from mine. Don't get close to bears. Yeah, I happen to be afraid of bears. That's one reason I say that. But yeah, you know, and I know that since then they've come out with research, but 20-some years ago that research didn't exist yet. It was something I learned by accident. That if we went out there regularly, we didn't have these issues. And it didn't matter what we did. It didn't matter if it was a picnic. It didn't matter if we went and sniffed trees. Talking about aromatics, that was, you know, something that caused great conversation among us. Sniffing ponderosa pine bark, for people who are not familiar with ponderosa pine, It usually either smells like vanilla or chocolate. However, on this one occasion, we were sniffing trees, and they'd been logging about 100 yards, maybe 200 yards away. None of the trees in the area where we were sniffing had been damaged or impacted by the logging, but the scent had still changed. They no longer smelled like vanilla or chocolate. They smelled fermented.
Wow. Well, I just want to say, first of all, well done figuring that out on your own, and what a great gift for your kids. You know, something I try to do with my daughter as often as we possibly can. But just in terms of sniffing trees, this is actually a formalized practice in Japan. It's called forest bathing, or bathing in the scent of the woods, and people prescribe it. They prescribe it for well-being. It's a very old cultural practice, and you know, I think it's just, and how do we talk about it? It almost sounds silly. It's obvious. You go outside, you hike in the forest, you experience trees, you experience nature. It's just plain good for us. It is our sort of native environment and our native home, being outdoors. We put ourselves in these boxes way too much. But, you know, it's a necessity of life. And look, we can handle it as long as we go and we get experiences like you did, make it fun, and get benefit from it. We can handle living in a box and being in this place where energy bounces off these crazy walls and is trapped inside these very, very square structures. But as long as we reconnect to nature even just a little bit, then we can feel healthy in our spirit. And that's the point I'm trying to make in the book. It's like, you know, we don't have to bomb ourselves back into the Stone Age. We can definitely enjoy and handle and adapt to the craziness of modern life. But we need to have these allies with us. We need to have at least a little bit of nature communing with us. And by eating these plants that, like you say, are still wild and not as domesticated, not as hybridized, we get to have that internal communion with nature. We don't need a whole lot of it. You know, we're talking about a cup of tea, you know, some soup stock or jam of hawthorn berries or blueberries. We're talking about a little bit of something there, be it from a green that you eat regularly or from an extract that you make of a dandelion root. This stuff is really easy to do. It can be super fun, especially for kids. And if our kids see us do it, then, you know, as the adults that they admire, they will begin to model those habits. And what do you know, I bet you their kids will start to use these things kind of as part of daily life. And by the time we're, you know, ready to move on, the next generation will be a generation of people who understand the importance of having a big biodiverse range of plants in their daily life.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I know that my kids enjoyed, you know, sampling wild foods. They enjoyed doing the oddball things that I would agree to, like cooking on rocks. Now, here in Mississippi, we'd be hard-pressed because I live in southern Mississippi where there are no native rocks. But we did all sorts of that kind of stuff.
Yep, that sounds excellent. And, you know, I'm just advocating for bringing that stuff back home into your kitchen, too. In these ways that are really pretty old and pretty well established, and boy, they might be an acquired taste at first, actually end up being, you know, about as easy to do as gardening and about as easy to prepare as making a very simple soup or stew or just pouring hot water over some herbs that you get used to on a daily basis, and maybe you use as a substitute for that super sweet tea.
Yeah, you know, I think about some of the things that even, you know, I have to admit, I've never tried this. My mother grew up, and they would chew wads of pine tree rosin instead of chewing gum, because they didn't have chewing gum.
Yeah, and people still do that up here in Vermont. Tree resins have been sacred and important medicinally throughout the world, you know, from things like frankincense and myrrh that were definitely prized in the deserts of the Middle East. All the way to pine pitch, especially even up here in the Northeast, we use spruce pitch and white pine pitch in similar ways as chewing gums. People also use propolis from beehives for chewing gums, and they don't only kind of have this weird chewiness, they also are medicinally active and antiseptic and protect us against viruses and bacteria. And generally what you always see. You know, you take the plant for one reason or another, and then it has all this range of positive side effects when you consume it regularly. And you'll see that with, you know, even something as simple as a blueberry or a cranberry. You may be taking it for urinary health, but what you'll end up seeing is that it will also reduce progression of inflammation in the arteries and help protect the heart, and really also help in preventing cancer and acting as a good adjunct to chemotherapy in the context of cancer therapy. So these plants are a lot more than just this stuff that we can get to know that's growing around us, you know, going from that place of blindness that you were talking about when you first moved to Mississippi, or you didn't really know any of the flora around the area, to a place of, you know, familiarity. They're also kind of our guides and our literal ancestors, our literal parents, and we need to commune with them by eating them, like bringing their essence inside of us in order to really be at our best. Cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes and blood sugar balance, and mental health, that tension, that anger, that irritability that you see in modern culture, all of these things are kind of different aspects of this plant deficiency syndrome, whether it be a deficiency of bitter plants or tonic plants or the aromatic ones that are so good for the spirit. You don't need to run away from sugar. You don't need to run away from toxicity. You can handle the stuff that the modern world has to throw at us if you have these very basic, very simple kinds of plants in your life. And
well, I still have to ask you one more question. I know we're getting close to the end. We only have about 8 minutes left. But one of the most common bitter-tasting things consumed in America is coffee. How does coffee get in it?
So coffee is, I often joke that it's the saving grace of the American culture, because it is the one plant that we consume regularly, and it does have a bitter taste to it. And, you know, the evidence with coffee is that it's really not that bad for you, especially if it's consumed at the 1 to 2 cups a day level. It seems to be protective to the heart. It seems to do a little something for our mood. And it, lo and behold, also seems to do something for blood sugar and liver health. So, you know, I talk about chocolate in the book, because I think it's more medicinally active than coffee is, without sort of as much of the stimulant quality that can be so jitter-inducing for some people. But, you know, coffee is a great medicinal plant, and it has a bitter quality. A lot of people tend to buffer that with sugar and cream, and that's fine, you know, if it makes it more palatable. But what gets to me is the carbonated water that has been dyed brown with caramel, and to which synthetic caffeine has been added, along with high fructose corn syrup. You know, and that's what we're talking about when we're talking about Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola or something like that. Why?
Yeah.
Why? Why? It makes me nuts. Drinking a good cup of coffee gives you the benefit of the antioxidants that are present in there, the bitter compounds that are present in there. Drinking Coca-Cola soda gives you none of that. And when you look at it, it's trying to pretend that it is, you know. It's putting in caramel color to take the place of the traditional pigments that are botanically active chemicals that help us. It's replacing it with this stuff that doesn't do anything for us. And then it's putting in the stimulant that would be present in the context of a huge range of other chemicals in a naturally occurring plant like coffee or tea, and giving it to us straight in isolated mode. And we can go back to what we were first talking about. You know, herbalists are whole plant people. And we look at sort of taking food and breaking it down into its constituent parts and then recombining it into this, you know, best guess as to what the body needs, which is what, you know, white bread basically is. Bleached flour broken down to its carbohydrate skeleton, to which a lot of vitamins and minerals that we think are what we're supposed to have been added. And, you know, it keeps a person healthy-ish for a period of time. But for our culture, over time, it really is getting us further and further down this unhealthy place of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer, etc. And coffee, I would say, is, you know, one of the things that might be putting the brakes on that, at least, because it is still relatively unprocessed.
Yeah, so my husband wasn't completely wrong when he tried to convince me that he survived the heart attack because he loves chocolate and coffee.
He was 100% right about the chocolate. We have clinical research and pharmacological research showing us how protective chocolate is for blood vessels. and how much more resilient it makes the cardiovascular system. Coffee, it's a little bit not quite as clear, but definitely the chemistry of coffee is very good for you. And again, if you're not drinking 12 cups a day, I think it's a great thing to have in your life.
I'm afraid he's probably closer to the 12 cups than 2 cups a day. But he, I have to admit, has cut his coffee consumption down to something even I can call reasonable.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad
we'd actually started
that.
Working on cutting that coffee down before he had, long before he'd had the heart attack. But, yeah, he was one of these people that if he was offered any drink of choice, it was always going to be coffee. And he will drink what I call bad coffee, you know, the stuff that you get that you almost spoon out of the pot at the truck stop. He'd even drink that. Whereas I will drink a lot of coffee, but if it tastes bad, I don't want any part of it. If it tastes burnt, which, you know, anybody who's a real coffeeaholic knows what burnt coffee tastes like, I don't like it. I don't want any part of it, these nasty tasting versions. And I'm not crazy about flavored coffees, but yeah, you know, when he was drinking 3 or 4 pots a day, I thought it was a little excessive, and, you know, I may have been right on that, who knows. But, yeah, the coffee, the chocolate, the bitter foods that he likes, and he likes a number of bitter foods, they may have made the difference for him. Especially if he'd had enough of the right things beforehand, so he didn't have all the things that led up to the heart attack. Or to counteract his genes, whichever, you know, may be most applicable.
Yeah, and I think that's another great insight from researching what plants do to us, is that our genes are not necessarily set in stone. And the way they express and the turns and twists that they take as they become us and get turned into our substance. And you can really deeply affect that process by eating plants, especially the tonic plants that I talked about in the book.
Well, and I've often questioned, you know, everybody comes, you know, their ancestors came from some area. And when you look at the genes that were passed down, those genes developed in that area. And logic tells me, at least, you know, geneticists may disagree with me, that you are probably most adapted to the foods that grew naturally in those areas.
Yep, I think you're probably right about that. It doesn't mean we can't adapt to new and different foods.
Right, but maybe you need to consider, you know, making sure that you eat some of those ancestral foods, you might say, as well as, and most of us come from multiple genetic pools, okay? Not very many people come from all Scottish ancestors or all German ancestors or all Spanish ancestors. Most Americans are not that simple. Most of us have multiple regions that have influenced in our genetic background. But often you'll see that there is a consistent type of foods that Germanic people ate or Scandinavian people ate, or people who ate in Western Europe or whatever, and maybe we should consider those.
I think that's very well put.
Or Native American, for that matter. Well, you want to tell everybody the title of your book and where to get it one more time, because we're about to run out of time.
Yeah, my book is called The Wild Medicine Solution, Healing with Aromatic, Bitter, and Tonic Plants. And it's about how to bring these plants into our life in easy, simple ways, in order to counteract some of the craziness of the modern world. You can get it through innertraditions.com, amazon.com, barnesandnoble.com, and hopefully at your local bookstore as well. A lot of bookstores are carrying the book. And again, I'm very grateful for this opportunity, Gia, and to be on the show and have this great talk with you. And I think you shared a lot.
I enjoyed the program very much. I do have one more question. Is your book also available in an e-book format?
It is, yes. They have, a Kindle version at least, and maybe other versions as well.
Okay, well, very good. People, go out and pick up your own copy of The Wild Medicine Solution. It's a very good book. It was written by Guido Massé, who has been our guest tonight. And with that, we are out of time. All too soon, as usual, but I hope that tonight's program has given everyone plenty of food for thought, as well as more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next time as we bring another guest, another topic, and a whole new idea for your consideration. You've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.